From the studios of KPCW, welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Claire Wiley, and today Chris and I invite an ornithologist and an author to the show. First, a new report on the health of bird populations in the U.S. has just been released, and we'll be speaking with ornithologist Amanda Rodewald about the findings in this report. Rodewald is a senior director of the Center for Avian Population Studies, Natural Resources, and the Environment at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Key findings from the new report show that more than one-third of U.S. bird species are of high or moderate conservation concerns. And then Rodewald explains which bird species are adapting well to human population growth and the ever-changing climate, and which bird species are struggling to survive under these conditions. Then we revisit our discussion with award-winning environmental journalist Sophie Yeo to examine her book, Nature's Ghosts, The World We Lost and How to Bring It Back. That is all coming up on This Green Earth. And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us now is Amanda Rodewald, who is Garvin Professor and Senior Director at the Center for Avian Population Studies at Cornell Lab. Thank you so much for being with us, Amanda.
Oh, thanks so much for inviting me.
Before we do a deep dive into the 2025 State of the Birds report, which we do want to get into, please give us a glimpse into your path into ornithology, what led you into this field, and tell us what it is that you do with the Cornell Lab.
Oh, sure. Great questions. So I think like many people who go into environmental or ecological fields, I really loved being outside. I grew up in Schenectady, New York. So outside for me was actually alleyways, you know, the little center islands with the trees on them, and going to, you know, for walks in parks. So not rock and ice wilderness that looks so magnificent, just your regular, ordinary, you know, backyards and city streets. And as I pursued those interests, I eventually came upon birds, you know, and birds are just so amazing to study. You know, they're fascinating, they're everywhere. And it turns out they're really, really excellent indicators of what's happening with the environment. So they provide a really useful lens for us if we're trying to understand the world around us and our actions. And so what I do at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology is really along those lines, right? And so I'm working with just an amazing group of colleagues who, you know, extend from, you know, engaging people in science and bird watching, you know, education, training, but we also do a lot of work with partners around the world about how we can use information that we generate with participants, just volunteers through programs like eBird, and how we can use that in a way to support the work they're trying to do out there in the world to improve environment and to make good decisions.
And I love that you did point out that birds can be such an indicator of their environment, their ecosystem, and conservation as a whole and what is happening with our Earth. And getting into that, there was a report that was put out. The 2025 State of the Birds report was just recently released. This is for the United States. And walk me through what the purpose of this report is, how long it's been going on, and what we can overall glean with it, and then we'll dive a little deeper.
So yeah, the State of the Birds is published periodically. So even though it's sort of in the process and people are working on it every year, to be sure, you know, we release it at different intervals. And it's been going on for, I don't know, maybe about, you know, 15 to 20 years in that range. And so it really is the product of a partnership, a coalition of different NGOs who are working in conservation and are focused on birds through the North American Bird Conservation Initiative. And so what we try to do is we use the science, the most recent scientific data that are out there to really kind of give the, you know, check the vitals on bird populations. That's the background. And it's intended really to help decision makers and to help managers and leaders in the U.S. to really understand some of what's happening with bird populations and what that might mean for us. right? Because it's relevant not only to those bird watchers and people who are like already kind of clicked into caring about birds, but it tells us important information about the environments that we're sharing with them.
So what can you say are some of the key takeaways of this report or some trends, etc.?
This report is really unique in some ways because it's following a paper that we refer to as the 3 billion bird paper. So in Science in 2019, there was this big paper showing that in North America, we'd lost 3 billion birds, which is, almost one in three individual birds from breeding populations. So, and that's since 1970, which is the year I was born. So in my lifetime, almost one in every three birds lost. And so what we're finding now is when we look at these different sources of data coming together, bird populations are continuing to decline and in fact even accelerating in some cases. And so we're seeing too that one third of bird species in the US are in need of urgent conservation attention as well. And so this again is telling us something, about birds. We care about birds in and of themselves, right? They're important for recreation, they're important for the services that they provide to us, like seed dispersal, pollination, controlling insect outbreaks, those kinds of things. But again, we live in the same environments as birds. And so just from first principles, we can assume that if these environments are not healthy enough to support bird populations, well, it's unlikely they're going to be healthy enough to support us.
Is the decline of kind of across the board, does it, is it upland species? Is it desert species? Is it marine-based species or shorebirds? Is the decline across all across that?
Yeah, great question. And check, 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 across the board on all of those. And so we do see, as a group, grass sunbirds are declining the most severely. They've gone down about 43% since 1970. Arid land birds, so those are birds that live in the desert southwest or like in the Great Basin, shorebird populations, those are also both down, 30 to 40%. And we're seeing the only groups we don't see declines across the board really would be in the waterfowl, our ducks, and the dabbling and diving ducks, and also some water birds. But even there, so as a group, we find that there are still some increases in their populations as a whole. But if we look more closely, we can see that they've been trending downwards in recent years. So that's showing again that even where we've had this success story, right, because of all of the decades of investments, especially that hunters, and anglers have, made into wildlife conservation in the US. Yeah, it's starting to trend downward, partly because of wetland loss and droughts. But yeah, this is again another wake-up call for us to really do something to address these changes to our environment that affect birds and a lot of the other values and benefits we derive from healthy ecosystems.
The breakup of the report is in breaking up these different types of birds, like you had described: grassland birds, shore birds, arid land birds, western forest birds. And what touches us here in Utah is mostly the arid land birds and the western forest birds. We can go out in the forest, we can see these birds, and sometimes I think we take it for granted that everything is okay. But a negative 41% decline for arid land birds. That's shocking. Can you describe to us what those birds are and maybe what they do for an ecosystem?
So these birds, kind of be a wide range of birds, right? From like greater sage grouse, where you're just, you're dealing with these charismatic species, to really small songbirds, or like pinyon jay. And so there's just a wide range of individual species that are there. The arid West has already lost almost half of the habitat, that's there. So it's a system that's been profoundly changed. And, we think about it, it's really comprised of working landscapes, working lands, you know, and these are areas that, you know, we have so many farmers and ranchers, you know, and others are depending on these areas for their livelihood. And so one of the places where we're looking in this report is to highlight areas that need attention to look for win-win solutions, right? And we try to highlight that with some examples, like the Audubon Conservation Ranching Program is a great example of a win-win, where we're looking at lands that we know, you know, there are so many human activities that we're not saying we don't need to use the land. Obviously we do, right? We depend on the land in various ways, but there are approaches and practices that can be implemented to make it actually more productive for, you know, the ranchers that are working those lands. And also better support people, you know, and there are better support birds as well. So I think, like, again, it's a lot of times what we're looking at in these systems is an intensification of the use of land. It's like if you look in the Midwest, for example, we've grassland birds have coexisted with people, with farmland for, you know, centuries. You know, it's the intensification of agriculture, right? That is seems to be a lot of what's driving some of these declines. And I think you could say the same with the way we're using some of the arid land landscapes as well. But there are a wide variety of factors that are contributing to declines in all of these groups. It could be climate change, right? You know, ag, habitat loss, all sorts of things.
Right. With ag, or perhaps the chemicals, increased uses of insecticides, herbicides, fungicides, rodenticide. Is that playing a pretty important role or an unfortunate role in their decline?
The use of chemicals has been something where there have been some large studies that have really focused on that. And so they are finding a signal that it does seem that these declines, you know, a lot of the declines we see are explained, you know, when you look statistically at the use of pesticides, you know, or other chemicals that you said, you know, herbicides, fungicides, that whole list. It's really difficult to pin it down though, because it's so diffuse, right? And we know that combinations of chemicals
Right.
sometimes have very different effects than when you have a single chemical that's applied. The timing of when these are applied, right? The amount. I mean, all of those things, these, you know, what are maybe might seem like subtle differences can make it hard to peg it down. But I think it is safe to say that writ large, right? The use of chemicals in our environment, of course, has consequences not only for the birds in them, you know, but also for people as well, and for our groundwater supplies, right? There's so much, at play here.
And there may be even some species that are more adaptable or more resilient to chemical exposures than others, given their diet and their size or so, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like as a group, there's a group of species we call like aerial insectivores, which is just a fancy term for saying like swallows and swifts, right? This is like the barn swallow, right? So they're eating a lot of insects that are emerging from aquatic systems, you know, from ponds and lakes and, you know, those. And so a lot of times, like that's a group that is severely declining. And it is thought that part of those declines are also driven by chemicals that are reducing their food supply, you know, as well. So you can have not only direct, you know, effects, health effects from exposure to chemicals, but also indirect effects by the way that chemicals might be affecting the foods or the other resources that species depend upon.
You talk about the effects that birds have on our environment and how they are such an important part of our ecosystem. And our relationship with birds has been pretty intense. We do talk with a lot of people that are professionals in the bird realm, but also bird watchers. And we just talked to Terry Messier, who is the hummingbird rehabilitator. And we have this connection to birds. Do you think that there is a wide knowledge about this decline in birds? And how do you get the word out that this is happening and get buy-in that we need to make changes and to do something around this? How do you get people to be more involved?
Yeah, that is a super question, right? And what's fortunate is bird watching, you know, and bird feeding, any sort of bird related recreation has just soared, especially since COVID. You know, a lot of people really turned to birds as a way to, you know, connect with the world. And, you know, when we were so isolated. And there was a report that was released by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that we highlight here in the State of the Birds report that shows now that roughly half of American adults engage in some sort of bird-related recreation. Yeah, so they are enjoying birds. And those activities generate collectively $279 billion every year. So, I mean, one way that we're trying to sort of get that message across is showing that the birds are economic powerhouses. They're, you know, they're an engine that actually is supporting rural economies and places, because you have people that are traveling, you know, to birdwatch in areas where there are good bird populations and interesting species, right? It's contributing to local economies by the purchases for bird seed and other equipment. And so I think that's another reason why, you know, that point I make where you don't have to care about birds in order to, you know, benefit from or care about some of the benefits we derive from them. In terms of engaging people, I think this report is an excellent example of how bird watching and participating in some of these participatory science programs like the Breeding Bird Survey and eBird, you know, are really transformative to our ability to both understand, you know, what's happening in the world, but also to respond quickly and effectively. You know, if we think about it, this report, the State of the Birds report, is powered by people. We're using data that are derived really from the generosity of just individuals across the country, around the world, that are submitting their observations. And that's giving us just, again, a new lens into being able to see what's happening in the environment. And so, you know, that's one step that people can take, because knowledge is power. We know that.
We're speaking with Dr. Amanda Rodewald. She's the Garvin Professor and Senior Director at the Center for Avian Population Studies at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. And we're talking about a report recently put out by the North American Bird Conservation Initiative titled State of the Birds 2025. Many birds are migratory in nature, and they don't stay within the boundaries of the U.S., thank goodness. Some of them actually get out of the country every now and then, going to Canada or Central and even as far as South America. Are you seeing a role being played by in the loss of bird populations from the migratory group? Are there things going on in those other parts of the world, north of us and south of us, that are having an influence on bird populations?
Right. And birds are just really amazing, right? These migratory birds do connect us across boundaries and really show us that the effects, why we have to work together internationally in order to protect bird populations. And it's interesting. I'll just say, like, we have this perspective that some of the breeding birds, these, you know, warblers that come up here, are like our birds in a way, because they're breeding here. But believe it or not, they're spending oftentimes like most of the year, you know, often 7 months out of the year out of the country. So really, they're like other, you know, country birds that come here to breed, you know, and to have their fun summer, you know, activities there. So, but yeah, so other changes in land use and are, you know, profoundly affect birds. So if they're losing their non-breeding habitats where they spend the winter, or the important areas that they use as they're migrating and stop over to rest and refuel, they're not going to be able to survive in order to make it back up here to reproduce. You know, so they really need habitat all along that way. And it's interesting how sometimes, you know, choices we make here in the US can affect really the habitats that birds have elsewhere. If we think about things like coffee, right? Shade grown coffee. We know a lot of birds. The Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center who has a bird friendly coffee program is one example. They started really opening our eyes to the fact that a lot of our migratory birds are spending the winter in these coffee farms, and they're doing really well there. And coffee additionally grown under overstory of trees. And so it can look rather forest like. And so, but unfortunately, kind of what I was talking about earlier, agricultural intensification can have some really negative outcomes for species that use those habitats. And so for coffee that's grown now in a much more intensive way, they've removed those overstory trees. It's basically like a cornfield of coffee plants, right? We call that sun coffee. Not so good for birds or anything else. You know, in those landscapes, other species. And so an individual consumer can choose to buy shade grown coffee, right? Yeah. Whether or not it's certified, you know, I mean, bird friendly coffee is great, but, you know, any coffee that has some specialization that shows it's grown more environmentally friendly is actually a choice that you're making, you know, to support habitat for birds and other species in the winter.
That was an amazing discovery for me, because I am a big coffee drinker. And I think that a lot of the times we do talk on here about that you can speak with your dollars and your spend and how the companies in which you are spending with and how they are treating our environment, that matters. And I do love to see we're thinking in those ways. And I really reflected on myself, and because of my coffee consumption that I have, that I want to be better and I want to do better and I want to spend my dollars in a way that is a more eco-friendly way. So it's such an interesting way to look at how we show up in the world as individuals and the ripple effect that we have.
Absolutely. And just to add to that, what's the beauty of coffee as an example to me is that it shows that this synergy, right? In so many cases, the actions we need to take to protect bird populations are also the actions we need to take to support people as well. And in the case of coffee, while we look at it, right, keeping trees on the landscape more, you know, like using less chemicals, you know, having more of that sort of forest-like structure, certainly good for the wildlife, you know, and other species, but it also reduces exposure to people to those chemicals, so it can protect human health. Right. It oftentimes has the coffee beans themselves, because they're growing more slowly, because they're in richer soils. Because a lot of times those trees are, you know, helping to fertilize and keep the soil healthy and to conserve water. Those berries are actually of higher quality, the coffee beans. And so you get, you know, both better quality of the coffee if you're a consumer. The farmers also are able to get, in many cases, a better price because they're in a specialty market. You know, it's really that supporting people and the planet at the same time, because that's really, I think, with so many challenges that we're facing out there, we need to shift the question to it's not about, right, do we take care of birds or do we take care of people? It's how do we best serve both? And those win-win examples are definitely out there in any system.
Mm-hmm. That coexistence too, we talk about a lot here on the show about humans are a part and interwoven in the planet. We're not sitting on top of it, and we shouldn't always think of ourselves as being paramount, but we're all connected.
Yeah. One thing Claire alluded to the last week or so, we spoke with Terry Mazier, the hummingbird rehabilitator in Southern California. One thing she noticed is that hummingbirds in at least the Southern California area are migrating less because in some ways they don't need to migrate as far anymore because they actually have a great source of food in the Southern California, a growing source of food and habitat because, as she described, people are crazy about hummingbirds in Southern California. So those birds are learning to, like, you know what? I don't really don't need to fly 1,000 miles. They keep up with my food source. I'll just stay here. Are you seeing any other evidence of perhaps some species or the role that climate change might be playing too in reducing the amount of distance birds might have to migrate, or maybe they're migrating farther north or south, migratory patterns shifting?
Yeah, there is around the world, there is growing evidence showing that we're seeing changes in migratory behavior. And those are coming from sort of different way angles, right? And so some of them are due to like urbanization and the how that is associated with additional food resources that species need, and also cities we know are warmer. So some of the hummingbirds, right? That's the case, right? They're able to stay, or sometimes even they're expanding their range northward, which incidentally has problems for some other species, right? Who they might outcompete, like rufous hummingbird, right? It's kind of tanking as Anna's going up, right, in the West. So you get sometimes it can have that tension there. We know about like Canada geese, right? We all experience like, boy, there are some populations that they've just become residents in species. And so there are those kind of examples coming up, as well as changes in arrival dates and the timing of migration. So one of the things that we're finding is that, when you have birds change the timing of their migration, there's the potential that they're no longer in sync with like when insects or other resources are emerging. And so that can have some negative consequences. So there's so much really in flux with climate change, both in terms of, when how species are responding with the timing of different events in their lives, when they breed, when they migrate, but also the quality of the resources that are available to them. You can get a lot of indirects that are happening that way. And of course, we know from a human side as well, right? We're also, our system is changing because of that. But even there, I'll just say with climate change and some of our challenges, thinking about migratory birds, an opportunity, an example of that win-win. So we know that a lot of migratory birds are moving through urban areas, as they're flying. So there are lots of things we can do to make it healthier for them and they're more likely to survive. So one is things like lights out programs, right? We don't want them attracted to lights and disoriented and colliding with windows. But the other thing is, and that has some benefits for people because it's reducing energy use. If you have lights out, right, that's actually going to reduce some of the emissions and the economic side of just lighting all these buildings. Another one is with planting trees and urban forests. These migratory birds are going to stop over and use those urban forests, but those forests are also helping to reduce extreme temperatures in cities as well. And so again, there's this win-win. We have so much opportunity to make a difference with changes that benefit us too. This is not about being martyrs. This is about making smart choices for people and for birds.
In the report, it is pointed out that there are these tipping point species. Can you define what a tipping point species is and what is being done to help keep them in our lives and our ecosystems? Because it sounds like some of them are being completely eradicated.
Yeah, and so with the tipping point species, this was really a follow-on to that 3 billion birds report in Science. And so a group of scientists and practitioners got together to look at the data and say, all right, what are the species we need to focus on most that require our most attention. It's urgent. And this group was defined as a set of species that had lost 50% of their population since 1970 and were on track to lose another 50% without action. Now, this report kind of, more subtly defines, different categories, but essentially that's this. These are species that are tanking right now. And so why we're really trying to draw attention to them is that in many of these cases, for many species, they're not at such critical levels that they're listed, for federal protection by Endangered Species Act. That's a really important piece of legislation, but that's like the last, that's the last stop on the train. It's, we need to act before by being more proactive, by finding voluntary measures for conservation that's going to be less disruptive to human activities, it's going to cost less, and it's going to be more effective. So by highlighting those species, what we're trying to do is to actually, raise their profile and increase the amount of proactive, voluntary conservation measures that are happening.
Yeah, and you see the list here, and it's long. They have them divided by yellow alert tipping species, orange alert, and then the most dire is the red alert. There's 42 on the red alert. There's 37 on the orange and 33 on the yellow. There's so many species on here, and I think one that hurts the most, you had mentioned warblers before, is like the Kirtland's warbler, because I grew up in Michigan, and I remember going up north and talking about these very unique and interesting, beautiful birds, and it's hard to see that so many of these bird species are in this position, and how do we curb that, and how do we change that?
Right. And, with Kirtland's warbler that you mentioned, that's actually is a story that now is showing when their populations have been increasing because of deliberate management on the breeding grounds and in the wintering grounds in the Caribbean. So we know we can really bend the curve on population loss for a species when we put our minds to it. And the sooner we act, the easier it's going to be and the more cost effective.
Dr. Rodewald, for our listeners, many of us have bird feeders and stuff in our backyards, front yards. Does that matter? And just as important, does our landscaping matter with respect to bird health and welfare?
Yeah, great question. So I think, when we look at it, right, our backyard habitats certainly do support many species that are common, and in some places, depending on where you live, species that are of conservation concern. So using native plants, having more structure, diversity of different native plants certainly is providing a greater range of resources for birds, but also for pollinators, and other species that we know we need to be worried about. Definitely. Right. Bird feeding can be a great way to connect with birds and enjoy them. There have been some, different studies will evaluate what's the effect of bird seed, on birds. In some cases, there can be concerns about like local outbreaks of disease. So you want to, sometimes there might be an advisory to pull it in or to take special care cleaning feeders. But overall, it's an activity that can, that can help birds. We sometimes say in the summer, if you notice it's just bringing in lots of cowbirds, brown-headed cowbirds or other predators, that might be a time when a lot of species are really relying anyways on insects to feed to their young. The big thing that, we just also want to highlight is that keeping cats indoors is really important, right? We, of course, if you care about birds and love them enough to, to attract them, you don't want to, lure them into where they'll encounter a predator. And trust me, I have a cat and she would love to be outside as a predator all the time. And, she gets by with being on a leash occasionally and being able to watch. The other thing would be collisions. We know that Birds are very vulnerable in terms of colliding against glass. But there again, and so, and residential glass, I mean, you can see, I'll just say, a lot of times in the news, you see highlighted these massive kill events, right? Like happened in Chicago. Those are important. We care about those with the large buildings, communication towers, but residential homes actually cumulatively do kill enormous numbers of birds as well. But there again, there's simple steps you can take with, you know, using decals or other window treatments.
Well, we
Okay.
could speak to you, I'm sure, for hours and hours. We would love to have you come back on the show, but we do need to wrap up. I just want to thank you so much. We have Amanda Rodewald, who is a Garvan professor and senior director at the Center for Avian Population Studies, walking us through the recent State of the Birds report that came out for 2025. Where can people go to learn more about you and also to get a copy of this report?
So they can access the report at stateofthebirds.org, and so it's free. Download it there, and you can check out the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's webpage. And we're in the Center for Avian Population Studies. So thanks so much for having me on. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much, Amanda. Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us now is Sophie Yeo, who is an environmental journalist and author of Nature's Ghosts: The World We Lost and How to Bring It Back. Welcome, Sophie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, we are going to get into all about what this book entails, but first, I'd like to get more information about you and a little background about your environmental journalism and how'd you get started in that area.
Yeah, so I've been writing about the environment for more than a decade now. First, I was writing about climate change quite a lot, but then I diversified to write more about biodiversity and the natural world. And that kind of ended up tying in with an interest I'd always had since I was very young in kind of culture and history and how we know about the past. And I realized that there was this unexplored area among journalists, I think, around paleoecology and how the past can impact conservation. And so I started exploring that and speaking to people, and it was that that really led to this book.
Yeah, so you kind of explained it there, but tell us a little bit more about Nature's Ghosts and the overarching theme or themes that play throughout.
Sure, it's really about the past and how by looking backwards in time, we can think differently and more sort of smartly, really, about conservation, how we preserve the natural world. In the book, I talk about the past in quite a broad sense. I go back millions of years in some case to explore the impacts of climate change over a vast time scale and how can that can inform how we think about climate change in the future. But I also think in much more recent time scales, like in the recent past, the last few centuries, how, for instance, looking at more recent but not really distant agricultural methods, for instance, can improve the sort of farming that is done today.
You do make an argument in the book for the importance of inclusion of rural communities in the conversations around conservation and the actual action in conservation. Why do you think that's important?
I think it's always really important to think about that human angle because the natural world is not bereft of humans. It hasn't been, you know, humans have been around for hundreds of thousands of years. In that time, we've always been impacting the environment in some ways, sometimes for better, often and in more recent times for dramatically worse. But I think that you can't write humans out of that story. You have to give them a voice, and humans have always been part of nature's story. So I thought hard about how to include them, and I hope I've done that in various different ways. You know, I start by looking at the impacts of Neanderthals, for instance, and in more recent times, how farmers in Transylvania kind of imitate some of the natural processes that would have played out there in that region in the deep past.
Can you give us some more examples of how you pull in these rural communities and ways in which they are acting in conservation efforts?
Well, yeah, to go back to the Transylvania instance, the farmers there in Romania, they still farm in a very traditional way, much as they have been doing since medieval times and earlier. And that's really interesting because that's a region. Transylvania is a region that has maintained a lot of its diversity, in particular, a lot of its floral diversity. And if you look at the science on this subject, that's really because the methods that these traditional farmers are using imitates some of the natural processes that would have played out there in the early Holocene. They're kind of acting in some ways as the extinct megafauna that would have kept this region open and given those flowers a chance to thrive across the area. So as those megafauna became extinct, there was a risk they would have been swamped by forests if farming hadn't come along and sort of kept the area open, acting like these grazers. So that's just one example, I think, of how rural communities come into my book.
I wanted to circle back to a term you use, paleoecology. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it's sort of ecology as we know it today, but looking at how natural processes played out in the deep past. And it's not as simple as, you know, today we can observe what's happening in real time before us. But with paleoecology, you have to look at these different proxies to understand how the environment operated, because you just can't tell by looking at it today, because we've removed so many of the jigsaw pieces of the natural world. So, for instance, to understand what forests were like in the deep past, a paleoecologist might look at the pollen record by looking at the pollen that was laid down by those trees at the time, which becomes fossilized. You can know what trees were growing and when, roughly. I mean, it's always an inexact art in a way. Or you might look at the remains of beetles, which can tell you about the landscape at a particular time, because beetles are very associated, closely tied in with certain environments. So a paleoecologist will look at all these different proxies, and it's a science that's developing all the time as a means of understanding what the landscape was like hundreds of thousands or just thousands of years ago.
Can we get a sense of what the planet might look like if we weren't here at this time? You know, would it be, I'm going to guess it would be dramatically different on an ecological scale. Has anyone tried to map that out?
It's a good question. I think it is at the heart of a lot of rewilding efforts in some ways. I think you can never know for certain what it would look like in the absence of humans, because humans have been a part of that system. You could argue they've been a keystone species in the same way that a beaver might be today. But I think you can be certain of some things, like there'd be a lot more disturbance, I think, natural disturbance in the environment. I know in the US, for instance, there's a history of wildfires being suppressed, whereas in the past, they would have been a very natural and dynamic part of that ecosystem. There'd be, the, you know, without humans, it's highly likely that a lot of the megafauna would still be around, would probably have mammoths wandering our landscapes today. Right. So there have all been all these knock-on effects that humans have had over the years. And I think if you take those away, you'd end up with an environment that was a lot more governed by natural dynamics. You know, there'd be a lot more death, I think, as well, a lot more decay. As today, we tidy away all our deadwood. Our forests are neat and tidy places, but a natural forest would have a lot more dead wood and old trunks and lightning hit trees littering the ground and standing up, offering a habitat that's been lost in many, many places.
I guess we might be able to poke around areas of maybe Siberia or some stretches of Central Africa or somewhere where humans' footprint, so to speak, is much lighter, and maybe that could give some insight.
Yeah, I think wilderness definitely exists on a spectrum.
Yeah.
I think even in remote places, you do have the impacts of humans evident. And I think also we have to remember that the impacts we have in our, you know, very developed communities, very intense communities, they have knock-on effects in places like Siberia, like, for instance, climate change that is being caused in places like the UK and America. You know, we're largely responsible for that, is impacting Siberia. It's melting the permafrost. So even, I think, if you go to the world's most remote locations, you can't really take away the global footprint of humanity.
Right.
Yeah. And I want to get back into the title of your book, Nature's Ghosts, The World We Lost and How to Bring Them Back. And you had just said something about rewilding. Can you, from your perspective, give us the definition of that and share some examples of maybe positive actions in this realm of rewilding?
Yeah, I think rewilding is a term that began with quite a specific definition and has been broadened out into it to have quite a popular definition. I think in its most basic sense, or in its most popular sense at least, it means doing any action that means the landscape around you becomes a bit wilder, a bit less tamed. So you can do that in your own garden, for instance. You can let wildflowers grow in your lawn. But I think on the more dramatic end of the scale, it means taking whole landscapes and removing the human influence to a certain extent and allowing natural processes to take shape again. I think probably the most famous example we have in the UK is the NEP estates, where they've reinstated a lot of larger livestock like horses and Tamworth pigs as proxies for some of the species we've lost over the last 1,000 or so years. An example I write about in my book that I think is a really inspiring example is the Carrie Fran Wildwood, which is an effort in the Scottish Borders to reinstate a forest as it would have looked about 6,000 years ago, when we did have these mega natural forests across the vast majority of Britain. So I think it takes different shapes. People interpret it in different ways, and they sometimes argue quite heatedly over it. But I think that, yeah, in its most popular sense, it's just taking away some of that control that humans have exercised and allowing nature to take the reins once again.
And clearly, we can't go back in time. And we already are so intertwined as humans. We're moving in tandem with our natural world. So what do you think that path is forward? And what, even from your perspective after going through this and writing this book, what do you see as maybe some positive ways in which we can create a more sustainable world?
Yeah, I definitely agree when you say we can't go back in time. And I think that's something I tried to keep mindful of as I was writing the book. You know, there's no going back to a pristine state. Our impact's been very deep and long-lasting. But I think I was trying to show that even if you can't completely create a faithful replica of 6,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago, there are always lessons to be learned from the deep past or just the recent past. So you can learn how to farm more sustainably. You can learn about how climate change might play out, and you can get more accurate models of that and how extinctions might happen. And that allows you to adapt more effectively and more efficiently. So I think we need to be looking at these lessons that are there in the scientific literature, but perhaps we don't pay attention to enough because we see the past often, or the trying to recreate the past, as something dangerously nostalgic or romantic. I think actually it's a very practical way. It's kind of the best blueprint we have for how nature functions in its most basic state, and that shouldn't be ignored.
When people read your book, what are some of the biggest takeaways that you want them to have? What do you want to maybe sit with them?
I want them to realize that we've become dangerously unambitious in what we're trying to do. I think we aim for a depleted state. It's this shifting baseline syndrome. And I hope by reading my book and realizing just how magical and ferocious and dynamic and abundant nature was in the past, we can broaden our horizons a bit and try to increase our aspirations to take into account some of that wildness that once was.
It's the nature of quote unquote humans to want to tame that wildness, to want to control it and domesticate it over time and then industrialize it. And as a result, it's to our own peril that we continue down this path.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, humans are already suffering from the impacts of climate change, from the impacts of extinction, from the impacts of, you know, things like soil erosion and flooding. And I think if we heed some of these lessons, we'll be creating a better life for ourselves as well.
Well, it's a big challenge with 8 billion of us running around the planet, Sophie. But I like your approach, and I like your, you know, the example you use of Transylvania and people living a less impactful life. I go back to the book I read when I was in high school or college by British economist E.F. Schumacher, who wrote the book Small is Beautiful, one of the first books about sustainability from an economist of all people. But that's what he talked about, you know, life in a smaller footprint. But it's a challenge. Hopefully your book provides us a path to show a footprint or a blueprint to help us in that direction.
I hope so. Yeah, I think I was careful not to claim in the book that I was solving every challenge. I don't think it's a book that shows how to feed the world or
right.
how to cope with, you know, population expansion. But I think it's a way of looking at how we approach conservation in certain places where there is that possibility. And there is the possibility in lots of places to create a better environment. And I hope that is what it shows.
Yeah.
Well, we appreciate you, Sophie Yeo, here with us, an environmental journalist who has just penned the book Nature's Ghosts, The World We Lost and How to Bring It Back. Sophie, if people want to get their hands on this book or to learn more about you and your writing, how would they do that?
Probably you can Google me or find me on Twitter. My name is Sophie Yeo, the surname, no one knows how to spell it, it's spelled Y-E-O. Yeah, just online.
Okay. Yeah, your website is sophieyeo.com. We are so pleased to have you on our program, This Green Earth. Thank you so much, Sophie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank you for joining us today. If you do have any questions, you have comments, or if you have guest ideas or show ideas, we really do love to hear from you, and you can reach out to us directly. All you have to do is email thisgreenearth@kpcw.org and drop us a line, tell us about a show that you enjoyed. Maybe if you want to get a repeat, you caught the end of one of them, but you actually want us to repeat it, or you want to know more about that person. We'd be happy to talk to you about accessing more information about some of our interviews as well. And of course, you can listen to them wherever podcasts are shared.